no, but I'm just trying to find a camera that doesn't make me look like Hitler. How's that one? Better?
Wow, that looks a little bit weird.
Good evening. You are listening to the Year Now podcast. Today is the 1st of May. And joining me this evening, I have Mark.
Oh, my goodness. You're really bringing this into the podcast, are you?
Yep.
Yes. I sadly, on my Mac, I look like Hitler at the moment because most of my beard has gone gray and the middle bit of my moustache hasn't gone so gray. And so when I trim my moustache on this camera, particularly, the middle of my moustache shows up a lot more than the rest and makes me look like Hitler, at least moustache wise. I don't have the hair to sweep across to one side for Hitler, but I do have what looks like, at least on this video call, a Hitler tash. Thank you.
Okay. And also joining us is Bronwyn.
Hello. I definitely do not have a Hitler stash. No, but my cat does. I have a cat. I have a Kittler.
You look a bit like Mussolini. Does that count?
That's mean.
What does Mussolini look like? Was that really an insult? I don't know.
Yeah, it was.
Hang on, I'm just gonna have to search.
You're saying I look like a doughy Italian is what you're saying.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's not a compliment, is it? I'm really sorry about that.
Our friendship is shattered forever for that comment. Shattered.
Although given Mussolini's reputation, there probably aren't very many complimentary photographs of him around.
That doesn't help. That does not help the situation.
I've even found a picture of him chilling out with Hitler.
Of course.
But Mark might have been thinking that you look like Mussolini in his true form, not the nasty.
As a fascist? His true form is a fascist there, Craig.
Okay, I'm going to set for Mussolini as a teenager. Let's see. None of this makes any sense on an audio-only podcast, but I think he looks like Mussolini.
Bronwyn looks like Mussolini as a teen. I will never forgive you two. This better be edited out, but it probably won't because it's funny, I suppose. Twisted little minds.
Yes. Anyway, so I understand, Mark, that you are a international jet setter.
Yeah, well, barely international. I went over the pond, across the pond to Australia on holiday.
No, come on. It's called the ditch.
The ditch? Oh, ditch sounds so
over
awful.
The ditch. It's over the ditch. Really? The pond is the Atlantic between the UK and the US.
Are you sure?
Yes.
All right. Then I crossed the ditch and I went to Australia. First time in, 5 years. So it's been a while since I've traveled internationally. And sadly, I am going to make a complaint to begin with. Air New Zealand didn't let me choose my normal food choice, which is to go for the Hindu vegetarian meal, which was always my little travel hack. Pick the Hindu veggie meal and you get a great curry every meal. I just had to choose the standard veggie and it was really boring and bland. There you go. Okay. So that aside, I did go to Australia for a week with the family. We had a nice family holiday at the Gold Coast. As I said in my article, my kids despaired a little bit because, you know, I didn't stop being a skeptic when I went on holiday. And at the Surfers Paradise night market, inevitably there were stalls that were selling nonsense. Luckily for me, it was some of the last stalls we saw. So we walked the entire length of this night market. And at the very end, there was one stall selling copper bracelets. And there was another one called the No Pain Club that promised no pain from sciatica and trapped nerves and all sorts of other stuff. And it had 9 active ingredients, including chili concentrate. And it was all just nonsense. And so what I did with that, because I'm so used to putting in complaints, was I thought, well, why don't I put in an Australian complaint and see how the Australian process compares to New Zealand? Because New Zealand, most of what I've done is advertising standards complaints. And, you know, by now it's pretty easy for me. I know what I'm doing. I know which parts of the code I'm referencing. And whenever I see something that's kind of, especially medical pseudoscience, I'll put in a complaint and hope that they get slapped down. In Australia, well, when I got back to New Zealand, I put in the complaint. But for the Australian process, their process over there is different. So I went to their advertising standards place, which the usual thing in Australia. They shorten everything, so it's just called Ad Standards. So I went to the Ad Standards website, and I couldn't find any kind of advertising code for therapeutic products. There was one for a code of ethics. There was one for motor cars. There was one for other bits and bobs, environmental, betting, food and beverage, and children. I think that was the lot of them. But there was nothing to do with therapeutic products. And it looked like you can't complain to Ad Standards in Australia about therapeutic products. But luckily, they did have a page that was titled What We Cover. And on that page, it pointed me somewhere else. So it said the Therapeutics Goods Administration regulates ads for therapeutic goods. So I followed the link, which took me to their health ministry website. And they had a complaint form, which I figured I would fill in. But while filling it in, I kind of learned a few interesting things about how therapeutic goods are regulated in Australia. And that was the interesting thing for me, like filling in the form and the rest of the process, once my complaint is heard and whether they bother doing anything about it is going to be one thing. But just seeing what the regulations are like in Australia and seeing what is allowed in Australia, it was surprising how different it was, because a lot of the work that's been done over here, at least, is to make sure that Australia and New Zealand are aligned, because they were looking at doing a trans-Tasman therapeutic goods agreement where basically we'd have the same rules on both sides. It never happened, but because it was going to happen, at least on this side, there were changes made to try and make things as close as possible, just to kind of pave the way for that joining. And so seeing that they have this register of therapeutic goods, I think that was something that we were looking at bringing in over here as well, or sharing theirs. But seeing what was on it, this was the disappointing thing. So basically, when you get to make a complaint about therapeutic goods, when you get to the form, it's got some really cool stuff. So it's got some handy guides on what you can complain about. It's even got an 0800 number you can call, so that if you're not sure, you can talk to a human, presumably. I'm assuming it's not an AI, and they will walk you through the complaints process, which we don't have over here. That's great. But they also say, what kind of complaint is this? And they ask you, is this already on the ARTG list? And the ARTG is the Australian Register of Therapeutic Goods. And this list really piqued my interest. So it's I guess they handle the complaint differently if it's already been approved for certain medical claims. So you basically have to find it on this list. And I looked and I couldn't find mine on the list. But while I was looking and failing to find this No Pain Club and any product that they sold to see if they were approved, I figured I'd have a poke around and see, you know, what kind of things have been approved. So my search that was a failure was just searching for No Pain. And in this database, it brought up a whole bunch of other products, like hundreds of products that had the words no and pain in them. And a lot of them immediately looked like they were herbal alternative remedies of some kind. And the initial page tells you basically what's in them. And it tells you a little bit about them, I guess, who owns them. You need to know who to go and talk to if there are problems with this product. But there was a PDF link to. So on the ARTG website, every product that's been approved to make therapeutic claims, that it has this PDF which has more details. And those PDFs were the devil where these details were. And looking at some of these anti-pain products, I started to read things for, here are the approved claims, things that you're allowed to say in advertising, like traditionally used in Western herbal medicine, traditionally used in Ayurvedic medicine, and all the kind of stuff that it's not actual medicine, right? This stuff is pure pseudoscience. And as far as I'm concerned, if there's this thing has been traditionally used for or in this method, in this modality of healing, that's not evidence at all that it works. That's evidence that someone's used it in the past. But we've used a whole bunch of stuff in the past that doesn't work. I mean, it's a good springboard. It's a good starting point. Hey, people have used this for hundreds of years to treat this. I wonder if it actually does anything useful. And this is where science comes in. But this isn't good enough to be able to make any kind of therapeutic claim. Being able to say, yeah, someone's used this for 200 years, 500 years, even 3,000 years, should not be taken as evidence of efficacy. And so Seeing that was kind of annoying, and unfortunately, things just went downhill from there. So I started to see other claims, like helps reduce slash decrease free radical damage to body cells, which, and I'm not a scientist, but I'm pretty sure that's another fluffy claim that makes a product sound like it's doing something where actually it's probably doing nothing. I imagine that's just an antioxidant, which is a preservative inside the product. And this is all they're saying. We have preservatives, which we like to label antioxidants, that may decrease free radical damage to body cells, which even that, as far as I understand, is arguable. Like, do antioxidants that you swallow end up being useful in the body? Or does the body, which as far as I understand is the case, mainly make its own antioxidants when it needs them rather than relying on what you're swallowing? So I saw that, and the next thing I saw was...
And the perspective on that for the evolutionary point is that over millions of years of evolution, why would we think that we should be able to add antioxidants to do any good in our body, whereas the human body has sort of optimized itself for a good balance of antioxidants against free radicals over time?
Yes, and I guess to a large extent, the diet that we're used to eating and the diet of foods that we crave, this is the stuff that our body needs. And generally, unless we have a particularly bad diet, our body does well enough with a balanced diet to get all the nutrients it needs. And you don't need to be swallowing an excess of antioxidants or vitamin C or anything else, right?
Mm-hmm. And really, realistically, the conditions under which we evolved, we were getting a lot less nutrition than we are today.
Yes.
Even if you eat crap food, you're still getting a ton more nutrition than people were half a million years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, so the next claim that I saw, and this is one that's annoyed me for many years, is that they are allowed to claim that they maintain slash support things. So this one example I saw, and I love having a rant about this one, but maintain slash support joint health. Now, I'm pretty sure from what I could tell that this is the same in Australia as it is in New Zealand, which is basically that this is a claim that really is saying nothing. What it's saying is when you're talking about supporting joint health, you're talking about this is giving the body something that it needs in order to make sure that your joints are healthy. And that can be as simple as calories. As long as it's calorific, as long as it's giving your body some energy, your body can use that energy in order to help your joint health. And so, as I say in my article, like this is no different to a cheeseburger, claiming that a cheeseburger will maintain or support joint health, because it does. It gives you calories. Your body uses that energy in order to look after your joints. But I think everybody would be up in arms if we let Burger King, or my little Australian thing, Hungry Jack's in Australia, if we let them advertise that their burgers helped maintain joint health. I think everybody would like, no, hang on, you can't say that. Burger King's not healthy. But in the same way as a lot of these alternative medicines, Burger King is doing the same thing. It's probably even doing more of it because it's got a crap ton more calories in it than your average pill that's supposed to be helping joint health. So yeah, the fact that they allow these, it's the same over here. Over here, we've talked with the Advertising Standards Authority about it, and they basically said these are allowed because, you know, technically these claims are true. And we've tried to argue to the ASA, it might technically be true, but what you should be interested in is what does the average consumer hear when they hear this? What do they take away from it? What do they think it means? And I don't think the average consumer will go, oh, that means that this thing has got some calories in it. They will think, if I swallow this, my joints are going to get better because I've swallowed this. And that is not what's actually going on. And so allowing companies to make these kinds of maintain support claims, I just don't think it should be allowed. And seeing how many products in Australia appear to have just been given a whitelisting for this, it's kind of disappointing, really. I feel like, you know, it's great that they've got this register, but it looks like the way they've run the register is just so lax and so accepting of anything that it's probably doing more harm than good, I'd imagine. I might have to message Loretta Moron and see how she's doing and see what she thinks about it. And she's a great advocate in Australia. We've had her, I think, twice over for conferences to speak now. She got cancer in Australia, she found that lots of people were trying to push alternative medicine to her. And then she looked into it and found that none of it worked. She got through her cancer and out the other side, she went, right, now I'm just going to battle all this nonsense that people were pushing at me and try and make sure that people aren't allowed to tell people they've got cancer that this nonsense therapy is going to cure them. So maybe I'll message her and see what she thinks about this RG list. But to me, it looks like it's probably, at least in alternative medicine circles, it's doing a lot of harm because it's letting companies, it's whitelisting companies to make a whole bunch of claims that, as far as I can tell, they just don't have evidence for. And they're allowed to make it because it's what we call weasel words. It's using these maintains, supports, promotes, these kinds of words that technically you could argue are true. But yeah, on a consumer level, no. The consumers will read something very different to this than what technically is true. And that's not fair to the consumers. And consumer protection laws are meant to protect consumers. They're not supposed to protect the advertisers, the people selling this nonsense. And it's not supposed to be protecting their bottom line. It's not supposed to be protecting their profits. It's supposed to be protecting the people buying this stuff from being sold a false bill of goods. And I don't think this RG is doing this in Australia.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I recall from contact with the Australian skeptics maybe a decade ago now that they were, I think, quite pleased with their Therapeutic Goods Administration Act because it allowed them to put in a complaint about something at the time. I can't remember what it was, but it was something that was being sold that was actually quite dangerous, and the TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Act, was pretty good at being able to sort of clamp down on that particular company. And it seemed, at least from the New Zealand side of things, that their act had more teeth. And
yes,
and at least the regulator would have been equivalent of our MedSafe, seemed to at least have more of an inclination to go after these people than MedSafe does here in New Zealand.
And that's really good. And MedSafe, certainly, we've talked with MedSafe, and MedSafe have said that, you know, they don't have the staff to deal with it effectively, which is pretty awful.
That soon.
Oh, dear. Staffing cuts at MedSafe?
Well, maybe. Anyway.
I get what you're saying there. And possibly if it was a product like Black Salve, which, you know, it is at the dangerous end, I imagine it's probably something like that you'd be thinking of. I think even over here, like, I'd expect MedSafe to jump pretty quickly at something like that. And yeah, so because it's a government departments, as you say, they have teeth. They have the ability to issue fines, to issue warnings, to take people to court. And over here, the advertising standards that we use for a lot of these therapeutic adverts, they don't have any of that. They basically have the ability to ask someone to please stop. And that's all they have. The more companies that realize they don't have to pay any attention to that, the worse it gets over here, unfortunately. But yeah, so nice at the TGA when it does stuff, it'll do it well. But in my article, I've assumed, and I couldn't find anything either way online, but I think, like MedSafe over here, they get to pick and choose. You know, they don't have to listen to every complaint that they get. They decide which things they're going to do something about. And they triage. They only have a certain amount of staff members. They have to pick the stuff that's worth their time, which is disappointing because, at least for us over here, the ASA does listen to every complaint. They make a ruling if it's got merit, which is great, but they don't say, oh no, we've read your complaint and we think it's got merit, but actually we've got more important things to do. You don't hear that from the ASA. They will actually do something with your complaint, which is great. But yes, that makes me wonder with the TGA. I guess I'll find out with my complaint, because it is a fairly minor one. You know, it's helping you with pains with a chili extract. It might fool a few people, but they're not promising to cure cancer or anything. But I'm interested in seeing, will they entertain my complaint? Will they do anything with it? Or will it just go in the round filing cabinet in the office and never be seen from again? I don't know.
Did you have to tell them that you lived in New Zealand?
No, they never asked. That's a really good question. And at no point did they ask if I was resident in Australia, if I, you know, anything about where I was. It was just about the advert. Where did you see the advert? When did you see it? That kind of thing.
I'm sure they think that how unlikely it would be that somebody would come across on their holiday and want to make an advertising standards complaint.
When I was in Canada and I picked up one of those little coffee club leaflet thingies and I read a nonsense advert on that, the Canadian advertising standards got a complaint from me as well.
Oh, the coffee news.
Coffee news, that's the one. Yeah, it turns out it's international. It's everywhere.
Has anybody got a segue to introduce my section?
Don't farm out your segues to other people. Do your own work.
Okay, well, so I was just going to give a quick update on some of the conspiracy lunatics that occupy New Zealand. And as I wrote in the newsletter, I sort of had a look at the New Zealand Conspiracy Loons YouTube channel, which, Mark, you pointed out in the past that it's very useful. They're doing a good job keeping track of some of the really weird things that are going on here.
And doing the editing as well, right? So a three-hour crazy rant gets cut down to 5 or 10 minutes of the juiciest bits.
Yeah. So the most intriguing one that I watched was one about this woman down in the South Island who goes by the name Rach Ruby. Her real name, it seems, is Rachel Brancott. The impression that I get is that she, from hearing her talk, she actually seems to be pretty well-spoken. And what I've read, a little that I have read about her, she seems to have had some sort of a career as a real estate agent. Anyway, has sort of gone off the deep end and down into conspiracy theories. Anyway, there was a video online that she recorded of herself doing a Facebook Live where she was essentially fleeing from a police stop. And so she'd been into
Oranga Tamariki.
That's right, Oranga Tamariki. Yes, and so she'd been in there and down in Nelson and made a fuss and started accusing somebody of supporting child trafficking. And anyway, so she apparently allegedly assaulted somebody in the at Oranga Tamariki and then got in her car and from what it seems is that she got pulled over at supposedly a random breath stop and then fled from the police. And then that caused the police to chase her. And then she did this Facebook Live where you can see all the red and blue flashing lights and hear the sirens. And she's basically calmly driving along the road saying, oh, they're chasing me, they're chasing me. Please, everybody record this. And then she's complaining about how they've done something to her tires. And then she's eventually driving on the rims because the police have spiked her tires. And then it sort of cuts to where she's actually stopped and there's a police person and she's yelling at them and spouting various sovereign citizen stuff about how she's not a citizen. She hasn't contracted with them and she's prepared to have a conversation with them, but they have no authority over her. So anyway, she got hauled into court. She got arrested, of course, because you can't just flee from the police and get off scot-free. And then the next one is this guy in Nelson. His name is Mark Thompson. He's known as the Nelson Knight. And so he turned up at the Nelson court to try and support Rachel, but he was chucked out by security because he was making a bit of a fuss. And then he did a live from the footpath outside the court. And then he started spouting all sorts of stuff about how there was this giant conspiracy in New Zealand about children being trafficked. Apparently there are 1,000 children that disappear every year. He claims that they are being sold for between $5 and $10 million a piece to people in India. And of course, India is going to come up again later on in the podcast. All these connections we can make, it's starting to sound like a conspiracy.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah, Mark Thompson's an interesting one. So, like, I've been seeing him in the background of various things for a few years now. Like, I think the protests, he was there at some point, and some of the other, like, counterspin and stuff like that. I've seen him in places at meetings and online where he's never really the star. He's never, I don't know whether it's just a lack of desire or a lack of ability to be in front of the camera, but he, so far, he seemed mainly in the background. And I think maybe he's like got a bit of money, so he's kind of able to help in that way. It's probably someone we should look more into. Oh, here we go. Sue Gray as well. So just looking up old newsletters. So, yeah, so Mark Thompson, I saw him introducing Sue Gray on the steps of Parliament back in 2021.
Yeah, we haven't heard much about her lately, have we? She seems to have faded into the background a bit, I think.
Yeah, maybe it did damage to her that she associated herself with Brian. Maybe that was a mistake for her.
Yes. Anyway, the other people who are the conspiracy nutters, of course, there's the Reality Check radio people. And when I was writing my newsletter item on Sunday, they had issued an email where they were promising that there was going to be a big announcement about the future of Reality Check Radio. And Mark, I think after I sent my item to you, you saw that an email came out at 8:30 at night on Sunday saying that their big announcement was that they had secured somebody to provide matching funding for them up to $250,000 or something around about that.
Yeah, 480,000. So they, I think it's just for the next week, they've said that, but they say they need 480, but for the next week, they've had various promises to donation match up to that amount.
Yeah, so I just went and had a look at their email tonight, and they've sent another email out. They're saying, are you ready for digital IDs? This is their next this next boogeyman that they're trying to scare people about. But then it's all about raising money. And then there's a link at the bottom of that email, which takes you to a web page that shows how much they have raised so far. So they've got a nice little bar graph showing that so far they've raised $361,496 out of the $480,000. And so they're saying that's 74.4% of the way to returning, because they're saying they're going to return with Reality Check Radio when they reach the $480,000 point. But that money, half of that is the matching funding. So this person who has said, I'm going to match dollar for dollar up to $240,000 to make up to the $480,000, they've actually put in $180,000 of that. So they're still $120,000 short. So assuming that people by the end of the week are going to put their money, their hand in their pocket for another $60,000, then the matching donor will then provide $60,000 and they'll get to their magic $480,000.
I mean, all yes. Credit to them. They have done well to raise 480 grand in a week. If they're telling the truth and not just lying with this bar graph, if it's the truth and they have done well, I wish as skeptics we could threaten to go off air and raise that much money. That would be really nice. But I think nobody
should
would
we end
notice.
The podcast now? We'll end the podcast now.
Yeah. Unless you pay us a ransom of how much do we want? Like $50 is that a good amount to aim for?
Have we got a donor who's going to match dollar for dollar?
Oh, you mean like 25 each? Or are we going to aim for $100 altogether?
But I guess we've always, like, one of our skeptics, Robin Capper, as you were telling me, Mark, earlier, has been long trying to get Reality Check Radio to be transparent about their finances.
Or Voices for Freedom.
Voices for Freedom.
Because they've promised that they would be transparent from day one, apparently, and they've never released the finances that they said they would release. They've never let people know where the money is going. And we can only guess, but my guess is that, they've probably pocketed enough of it that it would look bad to let people know how much the three of them running it have made.
And but also, like, when you think about the amount that they want to fundraise, that dollar amount seems really odd when you look at how many personalities, quote unquote, that they have doing shows. And what would be the sustainability of running a station if, of course, they have a physical station and they wouldn't be going entirely to, as much as they rally against a digital identifier being a digital station in and of themselves.
Well, the amount of money is interesting. It doesn't seem that great an amount of money to be running a station for the long term. And, of course, that money that they've received so far, that they're calling the grassroots funding, isn't necessarily ongoing funding. That could just be one-off donations. So this $480,000, how long is that actually going to last them? They may have picked up some more subscribers who are going to pay a monthly amount, But is that really going to be enough to sustain them, or is this going to be a yearly thing where they're going to go off the air and then say, here's our funding drive, we need this amount of money to come back up
again? But it'll be more than 480, because this 480 is only from the weekend. You know, they'd been fundraising for a week and a half before then, and we don't know how much that initial spurt would have made them. But I imagine, you know, they probably did in the first day or two. I imagine they did really well. You know, they were reported about in the news. I think everybody would have rallied. So it might be that their target originally was $1 million or something, and they made half of it in the first week and a half, and they're close to making the second half.
But even then, that still feels unsustainable.
Yeah, well, when you look at Sean Plunkett, he was had $2 million to run his platform for 2 years or something, wasn't it? Something like that. So not cheap running a media outlet, and particularly Reality Check Radio, where they've got lots of hosts. Presumably they need to pay those people some money. Anyway, we're just speculating. Mm-hmm. So the final loons would be Barry Young and Liz Gunn. So I saw a video of them. They were on some international conspiracy theorists show on the internet. Barry was kind of in tears, saying he was prepared to go to jail. Barry, is, of course, is the guy who allegedly stole the data from the Oracle database at the Te Whatu Ora, the Ministry of Health. So interestingly, one of the videos, they were saying that there wasn't any personally identifiable information in that data. And if there was, Steve Kirsch, who's one of these technology entrepreneurs who's now gone to the conspiracy theory mindset, he was offering $1 million reward for somebody who could prove that there was personally identifiable data in the data that was released. Now, on that, it does seem that you couldn't actually take out a record and say, oh, this belongs to this person. Because I remember we had David Hood at the conference who had done an analysis on Twitter of having a look at the data. And he wasn't saying that, yes, this data is personally identifiable. What he was saying was you can correlate it with a whole lot of other data and come to some pretty firm conclusions about who the people are that were in the data. But anyway, in this video that the New Zealand conspiracy loons put together, they then juxtaposed this with Liz Gunn doing another interview where she was saying that with this data that she'd seen, she had the names of the people who got these vaccine jabs, and she was able to look them up and identify who they were. And it was a very traumatic thing that she had to do. So who's telling the truth here? Is it that there really is no line-by-line personally identifiable data in the database that got released? Or is Liz Gunn telling the truth and she's seen the names? I kind of suspect that actually she's making that part up. And in fact, Barry Young probably has a firmer connection to reality than Liz Gunn does.
But Barry seems like he's living on another planet, so that's saying a lot.
Yeah, well, true. So Barry was kind of getting a bit upset on the video because he's apparently going to trial soon. But I just did a Google search to see when his trial is going to be, and I saw an article in the Post, and apparently his trial is going to be delayed. There's apparently going to be a year-long delay until a trial for Barry actually commences, and is that prompted some advice from a Wellington judge. You're joking, and other comments came back from the court when the proposed trial date was given. In the district court on Tuesday, Judge Peter Hobbs told supporters of Barry Young that he was being treated the same as anyone else. If people in the back of the court were concerned about the time until trial, they should take it up with the politicians and others responsible for resourcing the criminal justice system. So we've all heard about the back office workers who are getting their jobs chopped in order to have frontline workers. Well, it seems that maybe the criminal justice system people are being under-resourced, and so this is going to delay the trial until April 2025, which Barry's quite happy about. He gets another year to run around and promoters conspiracy.
But we've seen quite like similar like long tail trials, like what was it, Roger Blake, the living man, you know, that's been a long arduous journey to get him to finally, you know, receive some sort of justice in the court system. And, you know, yeah, he finally had to roll over. So I think, I'm not surprised that Bear Young is going to be going through a similar delay.
Yeah, they say justice delayed is justice denied. Anyway, and you were telling me earlier on that Lincoln Russ has surfaced again.
Yeah, there's been a little bit of noise on Twitter. Lincoln Russ is trying to start a church or build a church, but he's so far been unsuccessful, and it's been causing a bit of stir. I think it might have been in Christchurch, and just, you know, having his little get-together, so to speak, in parks without a permit, so causing a bit of noise for the local neighbors with his shenanigans. And I know you've had some run-ins with him, Craig, so I was kind of interested what your take was on the...
Yes, I have met him in person, but I don't think I'll be ever meeting him again, so...
And something else I'm actually keeping an eye on that came on Twitter from the Twitter account Hannah Joy Blake. Some people may remember, and maybe Craig, you'll get off calling people loonies, but I never got off calling people actual losers. Last year or so, I wrote a piece about Jolly Billboards and connection of some of the senior owners or senior officials within Jolly Billboards who were involved in this, you know, the anti-trans movement in Christchurch, getting involved in the local elections. And according to Hannah Joy Blake, she didn't give any names, but it seems that some of the people who were trying to do the local election stuff a couple of years ago are now actually trying to get involved with these like long-term plans that a lot of the cities and town councils are getting into, like these 5-10 year plans. And that's kind of where they're going to try to wield some influence. So my self-assigned job or task for the next couple of weeks is to see exactly like compare who was maybe our local conspiracy people in the hut and see if they're doing something similar and making similar submissions to the long-term plan for my region. And I think I suggest maybe several other skeptics across the country consider doing something similar.
I think Hannah's based in Palmerston North. She grew up as a fundamentalist Christian. So you've got the mic at the moment, Roman. You're going to tell us about an olive tree?
Yes. But I mean, you know, don't take my word for what I'm saying. I'm going to leave it to all of our listeners. Hey, Mark, I'm confused.
That was abysmal. I'm confused that you even tried that.
I thought that was funny. But anyway.
All of our listeners. Oh, my goodness.
Well, we do look forward to you one-upping us all for the final segment. But yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about Monet or Monate or Modern Nature. It's an MLM I initially covered back in 2022, back when they were starting to expand into New Zealand. Around that time, you know, with this MLM, it's really interesting. A lot of the anti-MLM commentators on YouTube are constantly decrying that Monet is on the down, you know, it shot up quite quickly, it became quite popular, massive influx of consultants. And of course, you know, you hit the saturation point and then people start to leave for another MLM. You know, you hit that ceiling, you know, you can only recruit so many people into your downline. It's just mathematical facts. And then, you know, you stop making money because you can't really keep up your downline. And then people can easily make a quick profit when they move to another MLM with their downline when they do that transfer. So it seems that, you know, this is happening again. So back in about 2021, 2022, they had two big Exodi or Exoduses, a bunch of senior, big influencers within MLM went to two different MLMs called Q Sciences and a crypto education MLM called iGenius. Both of those MLMs are now kind of failing and on their way out themselves.
So just as a quick aside, I did look up your use of the word Exodi, and I'm guessing you looked it up because it was correct. It's the plural of Exodus.
Well, some people say Exoduses, and I'm like, oh, no.
I would have said Exoduses, yeah.
Yeah.
But you were right. Well done.
Yeah, I had to check, because otherwise we'd have a long discussion about that and not really know. Yeah, but back on topic. So it seems that this time around, The new Extus is to an MLM called the Olive Tree People. Now, there is a bit of drama behind why people are going to this new MLM. It seems that all of the, you know, the consultants who kind of came up through the ranks after the last Exodus, they've now sort of fallen afoul of the new leadership of Monet. They're kind of coming afoul with the compliance department. So every now and then, the compliance departments of these MLMs will swing a ban hammer. They'll kick out a couple of senior consultants who may be getting a little bit too big for their boots. And technically, you don't really have a non-compete clause when you are a consultant for an MLM. Sometimes some MLMs will be quite strict and say, hey, look, you can't work for another network marketing company that's in the same industry. So like someone in a makeup MLM cannot work for another makeup MLM, but they can work for a clothing MLM or they can work for a crypto MLM. You know, there's some flexibility there, but that doesn't seem to be the case with Monet. So over the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of these senior influencers, very famous, some women who should never be anywhere near social media, to be quite frank, talking about the loss of trust. They're even sort of revealing some insider baseball secrets and admitting that, there's been a change in formulation, people talking about how the products aren't working anymore, that they're losing people's hair falling out. People get really spicy. So
this is hair care products and they're making people go bald. That can't be good.
That's been the big thing with Monet for several years. There's been lawsuits about Monet making people's hair fall out. So to have these former major consultants kind of putting out these little tiny bits of gossip, it's big in a sense. These are the people who would call themselves the lifers. They would stay with Monet. They survived the first couple exoduses or exodi, as I was saying before. You know, I guess deny that this is happening.
At least it shows that their product has got at least one active ingredient in if it's doing something like making people's hair fall out. So
yeah,
there's that.
Exactly. Yeah, there is that. And of course, another big thing that's happening is that their president, a guy named Stuart McMillan, also resigned. And now he's got a big lawsuit coming out against the owners of Monet because he's sort of claiming that they aren't paying him. They're holding out on profit sharing, that they're mismanaging Monet. And Stuart McMillan, from all accounts that I've heard from a couple of commentators, is a very popular guy. He's kind of the spiritual heart of this MLM. So we all know a lot of these MLMs, particularly out of Utah, very big religious structure. There's praying. They have prayer services during their annual conventions. Well, for Monet, Stuart was this guy. And he's sort of starting a bit of a business outside of the MLM sphere, which is about supporting Christian business people to make a profit while also being good, you know, while being a good Christian. What good is, quote unquote, we'll see. So there's legal drama there. And one of the things under that counterclaim that the owners of Monet have put together, and Stuart McMillan, is that he can't contact his own family members and friends who are still part of the MLM. He can't contact, you know, his former employees. So I think quite a few people have left. It's believed that some of the consultants who've left have left because of this lawsuit that's come out. So where are they going? They're going to the Olive Tree People. Olive Tree People has been on my radar for the past year when it first came out because it was absolutely bananas. The big thing about this MLM is, you know, yeah, they have some products. Like, it's a cosmetic company. They like to claim that they are waterless or largely waterless cosmetics because they use olive oil. Mm-hmm. Instead of water. And the idea is that, you know, well, if you're having water, then you need to, like, you know, water, what kind of ingredient is that? You know, aren't you being ripped off by how much you're spending for like 70% water? And you need preservatives then if you're using water. And now look, I am not a chemist, I am not a cosmologist or a cosmetic scientist, but, you know, water is a really important emulsifier. You know, water is, you know, you have to be quite messy. You have to be, you know, in a bad state to have a reaction to water. And it's not really clear, you know, you have all those sort of advertising tricks. It's like, well, what actual product are you comparing when you're saying, oh, most cosmetics have 70% water compared to our product? Well, you know, they have bunches of products. So, and the formulation's not the same. And of course, when you look at the ingredient list, Olive Tree People have water as their second ingredient on the ingredient list. So that means it's also quite heavy in water. Right. But anyways.
I thought oil and water didn't mix.
there's other things. There's ways you can mix it. Because what he does, it's less about olive oil. It's an olive elixir, which is made from olive leaves. So he kind of makes kind of an olive schnapps. And by he, I mean the owner, Thomas Lommel. His story is that he was a real estate investor And then sort of had a period of pretty bad, I'm not sure, mental or physical health. Didn't really like being on all these prescription medications. And so, and eventually ended up having a realization while he was in Germany about olive trees. So he ended up spiritually communicating with the olive trees in like Spain or Italy. And they sent him their energy all the way to him in Germany. And he became mentally healed by them. And he would do an olive tree meditation. And then he would also both increase his olive oil consumption from about 0 to 50 liters a year. So when we say consumption, he probably has, he doesn't, I mean, he puts it on his food. He puts it on everything. He does, he'll start his day with a couple, with a tablespoon, I suppose, of olive oil. But he'll also bathe in the olive oil. He'll have all sorts of facial regimes using olive oil.
That's only a liter a week. It doesn't seem that bad.
It's a lot. Every meal. You know, you do you eat all,
well,
you
yeah,
have olive oil?
Okay? No, no, but if he's bathing in it as well.
Yeah, but he's not like, it's not like a tub. It's not like a tub of oil. He's like, you know,
oh, okay. Okay. Right.
So, but you know.
I'm imagining he does have a bath full of it and he just changes it once every 6 months. Like it's a big fat fryer.
Yeah. True. But what was really interesting about this MLM is the, you know, the cosmetic products, the usual kind of claims about how good they are, how they're meant for. The big claim that he was making, and it's kind of a foolish claim, is that, oh, the intelligence of the olives will decide what care your skin needs. So rather than, you know, having particular cosmetic types depending on what your skincare needs, anybody, any skin type can use any product and the intelligence, the natural intelligence of the ingredients would cure you, treat you. But even better was all these peripherals. Like it's a, he has some pretty high tech peripherals or that he's claiming that either it's in development or they are available. It's not quite clear because he does have a section where you can buy this for $15,000, but it's also similarly listed under the coming soon. The big peripheral that he's selling is what's called the Big Olive. Now, really, all it is just a plaque with a copper or bifur coil, and supposedly it connects to the Wi-Fi, and then that Wi-Fi transmits the frequencies from the oil, the olive tree, to you from a grove in Spain. And they have these, it looks like they have these, like the setup, he claims to have designed his own machine and that machine is hooked up directly to an olive tree. And yeah, the olive tree communicates to the machine and the machine translates these tones back to you. And it uses what that article that Brad wrote for us a few months ago now about the, about 432 Hertz.
Right.
So the same sort of logic of these, what was it? Solfeggio? Solfeggio? Yeah.
So I mean, what even is the point in measuring the frequency of an olive tree if you know it's 432 hertz? Like,
oh, well, there's various hertz because I think they have these classes where you go, oh, 432 hertz does this. And then let's have a class where you're going to bathe in the sound of 216. Like, it's all the special.
Yeah. So I think 432, I'm not sure what that one is, but it's not solfeggio. Solfeggio is like the 396 and the 400 and something. They basically take three numbers that are three apart from each other and then add to each. It's weird. And apparently some of them are close to being actual frequencies of notes, but they're not close enough to sound nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can sort of experience this at home at the moment. You can listen to it live. There's a live stream of what are the olive trees doing today? And you can listen to you know, if you want to be generous, you can say, okay, they've taken these dendrometers, which are actual devices used in biological sciences to measure tree growth, how trees respond to like temperature changes. Like these are actual devices that are used in scientific surveys. If he's legitimately using dendrometers, then maybe there's some sort of software that they're using that takes the reading from the dendrometers and translate it into a tone. But yeah, it's also equally as likely that, you know, it's just made up. You know, or they got some sort of AI.
Even if it's not, and let's say they're measuring the width of a branch or of the trunk of the tree, that will change so slowly over time. Like the video that you had in your article, where it has these really nice changing tones along with like wind chimes, you're not going to get that. What you're going to get is a flat tone that goes, and then over time, over a period of months, it might change ever so slightly as this branch grows a little bit. But you're not going to get amazing music out of a slow growing tree. It's just ridiculous. So basically, the steps are measure the tree, send back to a central location, an app on someone's phone can connect to that, but then they also, you can wear a bracelet that connects to the app via Bluetooth.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and they've had different, so many different designs for this bracelet, and it's never really come to fruition. Like, they've used like sort of an iWatch design, then they kind of used one of those Fitbit type designs, and now it's kind of gone into more of a functional jewelry kind of design, but it's never been released. This app, I can't find the app anywhere. I can't see any actual prototypes of the jewelry. The only thing that looks potentially possible is this big peripheral, which is this big frame, which they are advertising for $15,000.
Ouch.
And that's not even the most ridiculous of all these claims. I mean, yes, you know, all these peripherals are based around the idea that olive trees can heal you. Olive trees have millennia's worth of knowledge. One of these early forays into advertising to the American market, within the app, it said, oh, you can connect and get talk to an olive tree, and the olive tree can give you life advice.
Yeah, gross. This part of the video was weird. Like, the idea that you can ask it a question and it will give you a meaningful answer. Like, no, that's not happening.
Mm. And then now they have, like, you know, under their sort of coming soon type products, you know, they have water bottles that are infused with the power of all, like, of the olive trees, and ear pods that are somehow going to be powered by the olives. They have like sort of Google Home peripherals as well, that's going to be like, you know, the little peripheral, the little, what they call the little olive, which is going to be the little coil in your house, you know, so you don't need the big coil, you can get the little coil.
But going back to the fortune telling quickly, I think in the video, the example was something like they were asking a question about making a decision. And
it's about going on a date.
The response from the olive tree was, I'm sure whatever decision you make, it will be the best decision for you. And it's like, oh my God, they've just programmed some like Barnum answers that will fit anything and make people feel slightly good about whatever they choose to do. And that's it. And it just will kick one of those out randomly every time you ask it a damn question.
Surely you'd be better off with one of those magic eight balls.
So the olive tree people as a company, or Olivita, which is its other name. Olivita is kind of more of the cosmetic company, and the Olive Tree People Project was the initial name for this whole let's connect the olive tree social, the original social network. It's been operating in Europe for a few years, since the sort of early 2000s, or like noughties or so, of some sort. They had these, you know, these faux homeopathy type storefronts. The move into the MLM, that's been around for a couple of years. It's just very, very interesting because of the high proportion of Christian consultants in Monet now coming over to the olive tree people. And some, you know, because these are talking trees. Why hasn't anyone said that, you know, this sounds a little demonic?
Right. When you, when I read your article and you mentioned the Olivita, it popped into my brain. It was a very similar sounding margarine that you can buy in New Zealand, is based upon olive oil called Olivani. So I wonder if I can just stick a couple of electrodes into a tub of margarine and get a similar result.
That would be so funny.
I've just zoomed in on one of the pictures that you put in your article, Bronwyn, which was the big dope, this $15,000 art installation, apparently Tesla coil. And
that's a cannabis. Those are connected to wild cannabis plants.
This is ridiculous, though. Like, reading about it, it's a Tesla coil. It's giving you the frequency of the Tesla coil into your office or home. It's 15 grand. You can use it for yoga sessions. It's connected to your own unique plant. I've just looked up hemp plants. For 15 grand, a hemp plant lasts 100 days and then it dies. So you buy this 15 grand thing, and after 100 days, your plant has died and presumably it stops working, right? This is, the whole thing is just overpriced nonsense. I want one.
And it's going to be really interesting to see how this company grows and crashes and burns ultimately with this influx of the MLMers, and how do these consultants kind of explain all of these promises the company has made and has not fulfilled? Because it's a big thing that, oh, we're going to use all the products. And that's easy enough to do when you have consultants using the cosmetic products. But eventually someone's going to definitely start poking the holes pretty soon, not only about the talking trees, but also, you know, the AirPods and so on. But potentially, you know, I was looking a little bit into it because I'm like, are talking trees demonic? Because I actually had to do this Google search. And it seems that potentially talking trees might actually be aligned with Christianity. Like,
I was going to say, I think
Yeah,
they're more godly,
trees.
Right?
Yeah.
There was the burning bush, wasn't there?
Yeah. So
I can see, like, there must be, if they're selling any of these, they're doing well, because it's 15 grand, but then it's a $50 a month subscription, I guess, to keep up the connection with your hemp plant or your olive tree. That's anything that's like, you know, software as a service, anything as a service, you're making good money. So good on them for getting in line with how companies are doing things these days and making sure they've got a recurring revenue stream.
Yeah. And potentially if they ever get that own your own olive tree subscription off the ground, which can be about $1,000 a year or $5,000 a year, that could also be another good moneymaker. But both the big dope, the big olive, which are those big peripheral framing artworks, as well as the tree subscription, they've been in sort of this limbo for a couple of years at least, you know, as a going to be coming soon, join up to our newsletter for updates.
Okay, so nobody's actually bought one of these then, as far as you can tell.
See, when I looked at the archive version of this website in 2017, they have these like testimonials of people saying, oh, this was in my office. You can't really trace those testimonials. You know, and they're also
testimonials.
Yeah. You know, and like you have those really well done pictures of these, you know, big frames in people's homes, but there's no, you know, you don't know if they're real or they're fabricated and fake. So there's a lot of smoke and mirrors with this MLM. Watch this space.
Hey, that's my line.
Yeah. Rest assured, I will be giving you the updates as we watch the crash and burn. But I'm also interested. I mean, you know, they're only expanded into the US at the moment. They haven't expanded into Canada. I don't see the Monet consultants in New Zealand talking about this, even though some international consultants who were advertising in New Zealand for Monet year, like last year, are now with the olive tree people. So I'm keeping an eye out to see if potentially they may try to expand into New Zealand. I don't think they would. We are far too small of a market.
So a really weird side question, now that you've re-mentioned Monet, any idea why it's pronounced Monet, even though it's spelled M-O-N-A-T? I've looked it up and that looks like the correct pronunciation for it, right?
Yeah, not a clue. So some people have said Monat.
Yeah. Monat or Monar seems more likely than Monet, given that it's A-T at the end.
Yeah, but I pick my pronunciation up from a lot of the YouTube commentators.
That seems to be how it's generally agreed. I'm reading a Reddit thread from 5 years ago that also mentioned that, you know, maybe it should be pronounced Nor, like, Nor, I don't want to lose all my hair. so it seems like the hair thing's been around for a while. Yeah, it seems like yours is the correct pronunciation. It just doesn't make sense given the spelling.
I mean, particularly because it's modern nature, so you would think modern Monat. And I think earlier commentators were using the Monat, but yeah, everything's just sort of made it softer. Fancier.
Made it sound more exotic.
Like bucket versus bouquet, you know?
Bouquet, yes. So many people won't get that reference.
No, probably.
No. Hopefully enough of our audience are young enough that they don't get that reference. We're reaching a new generation with skepticism.
Okay. So I understand that we've all been watching TV recently, and we watched a 3-part series on TVNZ On Demand where people were escaping Utopia.
Yeah, why would you want to escape Utopia? That just seems like the wrong thing to do. You should stay there if it's really Utopia.
If it really is Utopia, yes. It was Glory of Ale.
So, yeah, this is like the second documentary that's sort of come out in a couple of years. Mark, you and I and a few other skeptics in Wellington went and saw the screening. Was it last year or the year before?
Could have been the year before last.
Of the, you know, not the TV documentary. This is the film. And now this is a 3-parter that's being aired on TVNZ On Demand. That's been out for a couple of months now.
And thank goodness we're getting to the point where stuff is coming out that's properly critical of Glory of Ale, because they've been made out to be this fun, quirky little group in the middle of nowhere for too long. But the harm that they're doing is just horrific. And I think, you know, TV glossing over that is not okay.
And I think it's kind of, you know, even though they don't really, they use the old clips, they use them quite sparingly. No one really talks exactly about that agreement, about how that original documentary, or, you know, I shouldn't say the original documentaries, you know, it's quite clear, particularly if, you know, when we're looking at those episodes, that people have known that some crazy stuff has been happening at Gloria Vale for quite a long time. And just somehow, as we see with a lot of groups, high demand groups and cults in New Zealand, you can have a run in with the police and your leaders can still get away scot-free.
Yep, or they can go to jail for a while and come straight back out, rejoin the cult group, and carry on running it the same way it was before.
Yes.
As
yes,
we've so... seen in, what, Centerpoint and Gloria Vale and probably and more over here.
And, like, Camp David, I mean, that place was raided by the police and the military.
Yeah, so Hopeful Christian only went to jail for 11 months, didn't he, out of a six-year sentence. Seems pretty short.
Yeah. But yeah, I think the big thing for this new show, and definitely recommend that listeners watch it, is, I mean, we told you, Craig, you know, make sure you watch that third episode, because that revelation about the Indian offshoot that they've made, that pretty horrific to see.
Yeah, weird, isn't it? It feels to me like a sort of a cut price version of Gloria Vale. They've kind of take the essentials to a remote part of India where I guess people are living in poverty and trying to set themselves up there the same as they have in New Zealand, but there's the added disadvantage of distance.
Well, I mean, it goes back to trafficking. I mean, we saw, you know, that's something that's happened when I was writing about Camp David. I mean, it's about women being moved out of the country or being moved across country for, you know, really for sexual purposes. But how do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? You know, what are the legal ramifications? What is the legal response? And that's sort of a big question that they try to answer in the end of that third episode, because, who actually has the right? Do these women actually have that personal autonomy and decision-making authority if they're going over as adults, but you're an adult in a cult?
When it comes to things like coercion and whether people are giving permission or, you know, willingly doing this, of course, as we see in cults all the time, and I think this documentary did a good job of it as well, the people who are in it will swear blind that everything they're doing is being done freely of their own volition. And everybody that comes out of a cult will put paid to that lie and say, no, of course I'd say that while I was in the cult because I knew I'd get in trouble if I didn't, or because I was enamored with the leader and didn't know any different. And so it's just the same old thing. Like, you can't trust these people who are saying, no, it's fine, it's not trafficking, it's not a problem because I chose to do it. It's only when they come out and they're able to look back at what actually happened that we finally get to hear the true story. And so I really hope as much as possible the courts don't take these women who are still in Gloria Vale at their word and they have that nuanced understanding. And I think from the court battle so far, it looks like that has been happening. But, you know, there's a real risk that you can just take people at their word and go, oh no, they all tell me they're fine inside this cult, when we know from history that that's just not going to be the case.
I thought a particularly sad part was towards the end where the sister who'd got out managed to call her sister in India and talk to her on the phone, and it was apparent when they were talking in the conversation that they really had nothing to talk about. That the sister in India was there, and she just she was in a completely different world from the sister who'd got out and had now made a life and was living in Auckland and had got a career and been to university, and there was just nothing to talk about.
One of the things that I was interested in, I sort of followed this up on the Gloria Vale Leavers Trust website. This isn't the only potential. This is the, like, they tried to have other settlements internationally in the past. I think there was an effort to have a partnership with a church or a community in Kenya. Feelings about that, about how authentic that was mixed, if that was potentially just a scam, or whether, you know, things just never developed to the full wearing blue stage. and then Gloria Vale just is still kind of eventually like sort of supporting this community of this other church on and off.
So a scam, as in Kenyan people taking money and pretending to set up a new place?
I'm not entirely sure if it's whether Gloria Vale is sort of, you know, using money in a little bit of a funny way.
Oh, okay.
Who was being scammed?
Yeah, who was being scammed.
Huh.
But I think, you know, the third episode is definitely like, you know, I think for people who don't follow Gloria Vale or think it's sort of just a bunch of harmless Christians, yeah, definitely that third episode is a really striking episode. I think the second one, however, is probably going to be a lot more interesting for people who've been longtime followers, because we actually do get the follow up on a couple of the figures from the past documentary, as well as from the, you know, the earlier TV series. So we catch up with Pearl Valor. She was sort of one of the stars of the Glory Vale TV, the original Glory Vale TV series. We get to see how she is, and now that she is out of Glory Vale, we also get to follow with Sharon Reddy. Now, if you've watched the film documentary, Sharon was like, you know, I'm not going to leave Glory Vale, you know, wanted to speak out, had a very complex, you know, very complicated history with Glory Vale. She is still there, but she's, you know, kind of excommunicated. So her and her husband are living in like an abandoned airplane hangar.
Yeah. Yeah, that was weird to see and really unfortunate. But I mean, you know, the fact that she's sticking it out through all of that, that she's not just packing up and leaving, it's so brave. So ridiculously brave to try and fight to make things better inside Gloria Vale.
But I guess it's, you know, what we also got a little bit of an insight on is like this business, you know, like an abandoned airport hangar. What happened to their airport? What happened to their flying business? You're no longer able to hide your women in remote cabins anymore. I know they sold their hunting and game business. I think that got sold during the pandemic.
Right.
You know, so it's interesting. But Liz Gregory does make a really interesting statement about, you know, it's not about like it's about power, not about money. But she did estimate that they were sitting on potentially about $60 million worth of assets, which is, you know, I think that was kind of a figure that we were interested in when we saw the documentary at the film festival a couple of years ago. It's like, how much money does Gloria Vale bring in for New Zealand in terms of all these businesses that they have? You know, and seems that, you know.
You think they could help fund RCR? But maybe
I think RCR is a little bit too, RCR is a little, yeah, RCR is a little bit too worldly for Gloria Vale. Chantal Baker, independent female reporter.
But I think for me, once again, with, you know, this new Gloria Vale documentary series, I just watch it and I despair that the government's not doing more. It was the same when I learned about Centrepoint. And, you know, the more that you learn the details and how it was publicly known, how everybody knew that something was going horribly wrong, and then you learn that the government is very late to do anything about it. I think we need to be proactive, and I think probably a country like New Zealand is better placed than a lot to be able to do something. But again, there's just that, I get the feeling maybe that governments are just scared to tread on religious liberty, even though in reality, people are being abused. Hundreds of people are being abused physically, mentally, sexually. It's horrible, and it shouldn't be happening.
But, you know, this is like, think about the news that's come out over the past couple of weeks about the FBI's interest in the activities of the 2x2 sect in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, we've talked about the 2x2. I've talked about the 2x2s and written about the 2x2s for the newsletter for this podcast. For people who don't remember, 2x2s are a very sort of secretive Christian sect from Ireland, very much very prominent around farming communities, and they kind of have home churches. So it's really, you know, you don't have an external building. If they do use something out in the community, they rent it. Otherwise, it's members coming together in people's houses. It's based on the idea of itinerant preaching. So a group of preachers traveling in 2x2s will go and, you know, do a rotation around followers' homes and stay in their homes. But the problem is, because of the secretiveness of the community and this sort of 2x2 traveling preacher model, a lot of children, young women are being abused. So here we are. We now have international interests. So what is the government going to do? Or again, are they not going to do anything?
They'll be under-resourced to do anything, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So what's coming up around the country?
Got a couple of things coming up. It's the first week of May, or the first, you know, 10 days of May are a little bit busy for skeptics. This Friday in Wellington, we have our bi-weekly Skeptics in the Pub regular meetup. That's at the Intercontinental Hotel at 6 p.m. We're going to be in the lounge inside the hotel. It's a great time. There, you know, food, beverage, and great chats and great banter. In Dunedin, then on Thursday, May 9th at 6 p.m., the Dunedin Skeptics in the Pub are meeting at Umbrello's Kitchen and Bar. It's always good, though. We have a couple pages for all of our Skeptics in the Pub meetups in New Zealand on meetup.com. So it's always good to just sort of RSVP. And if you have any questions, you can reach out to the coordinators of all these different meetup groups there. And Mark, do we have anything else going on?
Yeah, so Thursday the 9th in Wellington, we've got our activism meeting, Fork and Brewer, from 6 o'clock, maybe 6:30, depending on when we get to the pub. Turn up, make a complaint, get a free beer.
And, of course, Auckland Skeptics in the Pub will be on next Tuesday, the 7th of May. We will be back at the Dyson Fork.
All righty. And now just save the date and maybe get a jump start on getting your tickets and accommodation sorted. November 15th to 17th is going to be our joint conference with the NZARH, or the New Zealand Association of Rationalists and Humanists. It'll be our conference at the Fickling Convention Centre in Mount Roskill, Mount Albert. It's sort of on that cusp of two or three different suburbs, isn't it there, Craig?
Three Kings.
Yeah.
Are you guys doing a road trip up?
I'm flying up.
Oh, are you? Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm going to fly up a little bit early.
Am I road tripping alone? This is worrying. Anybody in Wellington want to go on a road trip up to the conference in Auckland mid-November? Just give me a call. Email me at podcast@skeptics.nz. Bronwyn, you're a quitter. I'm disappointed.
Who knows? We need to see what these flight costs are turning out to, because it is, quite seriously, if we really want our Aucklanders to show up for this conference this year, come out in droves, come out and support. There are a lot of concerts going on around that 2-week period, so you definitely want to get in early on your hostels and your hotels.
Yeah, I was hoping to drive up and sleep on Craig's fake lawn.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That was my plan.
I wonder how much I can get for that.
I don't know. Apparently there was a burn mark in it, so I guess it's probably not worth much to sleep on that.
That's long been replaced.
Not even pristine anymore.
It's been replaced.
Oh, well done you. All right. Well, maybe it's worth $10 a night.
Are you going to pitch a tent? You know, put some peg holes through my grass?
Yeah. And then I'll probably have to pay for a re-grassing or a re-astroturfing. What is it? What is it that you've got? Fake grass of some kind?
It's called tiger turf.
Tiger turf. Oh.
Fancy.
Yeah. Anyway, yes, we'll see what we can do. That's not awesome. That's not a general invitation for all skeptics to come and stay at my place.
Yeah, Craig B&B.
Craigslist.
Hey, there it is.
That's a good one.
All right. Well, you have been listening to the Year Now podcast. As Mark has alluded, if you would like to give us some feedback or register for a road trip with Mark, send us an email, podcast@skeptics.nz. We will see you all next time. Goodbye.
Thank you, Jay.
Sorry, I wasn't sure, Bronwyn, which one of us was going to go next.
Neither.
Nope. Bye, everyone.
Unscripted.